From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a deal with Iran, religious freedom and gay rights in Indiana and Arkansas, a massacre in Kenya, and California thirsty. After marathon talks with Iran over its nuclear program, a framework deal has been reached. Yesterday, President Obama began selling it right away.
It is a good deal. A deal that meets our core objectives. This framework would cut off every pathway that Iran could take to develop a nuclear weapon.
Indiana, then Arkansas, in the national spotlight over religious freedom bills and gay rights. Indiana reeling. Here's Indiana Governor Mike Pence midweek.
Was I expecting this kind of backlash? Heavens, no.
And mandatory water cuts in dry California. Governor Jerry Brown issued his executive order from dry, bare ground in the Sierra Nevada mountains that would normally be covered in 5 feet of snow.
People should realize we're in a new era. The idea of your nice little green grass getting lots of water every day, that's going to be a thing of the past.
A thing of the past. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Lisa Desjardins of PBS NewsHour, Michael Crowley of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you say on the Iran nuclear deal, on Indiana, Arkansas, religious freedom, gay rights? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Lisa Desjardins, political editor for PBS NewsHour. Lisa, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Lisa, and Michael.
Behind us there, Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif greeted by cheering crowds at Tehran's international airport when he returned from Switzerland after the framework nuclear deal was announced. And here, yesterday at a press conference, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry saying the nuclear deal will ensure strict inspection of Iran's nuclear program.
Not only will inspectors have regular access to all of Iran's declared facilities indefinitely, but they will also be able to monitor the facilities that produce the centrifuges themselves and the uranium that supports the nuclear program. And they will be able to do that for at least 20 years.
Michael Crowley, President Obama says right off the bat, this is a good deal. How will that be judged, Michael?
Well, Tom, it's going to be hard to judge whether this is a good deal in the near term in terms of the substance of it, because it's a deal that projects out for much of it a decade and many other parts more than a decade. And the big question is, will it prevent Iran from developing a nuclear bomb? And we're hopefully not going to have a negative answer to that in the short term, and it will be a long time before we have a positive answer. It could be that Iran violates the deal and cheats, and then we'll know it's a bad deal. And I think the biggest question, the nearest term question is, you know, does Congress decide that it's a bad deal? And it's a political question. Does Congress intervene? Does Congress insist on an up or down vote that could cause the Iranians to say that the deal is invalidated? And that blows the deal up. And whether or not it was a substantively good deal or substantively bad deal, the politics will have turned it into a bad deal. So whether or not it's a good deal is hard to say as a matter of fact. It's subject to interpretation. And that's the game in Washington in the next couple of weeks. President Obama pleading with Congress saying, this is a good deal. Please don't blow it up. And there are a lot of people on Capitol Hill who are not sure they agree.
Different emphasis in the descriptions from the two countries. Of course, it's more than two. You've got major world players involved here. But the U.S. and Iran really hammering this out. Here was Iran's foreign minister at a press conference in Switzerland yesterday saying that, and this is what Iranians wanted to hear, sanctions will be lifted eventually. Big sticking point for Iran.
All Security Council resolutions will be terminated. All U.S. nuclear-related secondary sanctions as well as EU sanctions will be terminated when we implement our measures. There won't be no sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
And thence the hooting and hollering and cheering, but that takes some steps. Michael, give us the basic elements. It's just a framework. There are a lot of details to be negotiated here. American negotiators, John Kerry and Moore, saying there's no guarantee that that will all work out. But the basic elements of this framework, Michael?
Well, Tom, to boil it down, I mean, the core goal here was to set up a system so that Iran could not produce a nuclear bomb in less than 1 year's time. That's the amount of time the U.S. and its negotiating partners decided was about what they would need to detect, verify, and prevent any Iranian move to harness this, what they say is a peaceful civilian energy nuclear program, and try to put it toward a military purpose and build a bomb. There's some dispute about whether a year is enough time. That's the goal. That is what the deal seeks to accomplish. And very briefly, what it does is reduces substantially the number of centrifuges Iran can operate. These machines spin at very high speeds and enrich uranium into a form that can be used to power reactors. Or if you continue to enrich the uranium, you can put it into a nuclear bomb. They're going to have to go down from 19,000 centrifuges to 6,000 and 10,000 that they are now operating down to 5,000. Either ship out of the country or dilute their stockpile of sort of partly enriched uranium, which is uranium that's been is sort of midway through the process to being ready for a bomb. It's suitable for a reactor. If you do a little more work on it, you can turn it into a bomb. They're going to have to do something to get rid of that. They're going to have to stop enriching uranium in a facility that's underground that we're very concerned about, because we may not be able to bomb it to smithereens if we have to. And they are finally going to have to accept very intrusive inspections, monitoring, and transparency measures that will allow the international community to have a really good look at what they are doing from the beginning of the supply chain, the uranium mines that Iran has there, to their research into centrifuges that can spin faster and more efficiently, to what exactly they're doing with their material. And the idea is that we can blow the whistle on them right away if they do cheat. And Tom, there's a couple other provisions, but we can come back to them later, and we'll let some other people jump in.
I want to come to the political implications at home, but one more question for you. The fundamental objection to this, Michael, because you've got different timelines in here, 10 years of this, 15 of that, 20 or 25 of another, but the critique that's come from critics and from abroad, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying a deal based on this framework, in a statement he said, would threaten the survival of Israel. Because the critique is, once this time period is passed, Iran would more or less be free to go ahead and develop a nuclear weapon. And the fundamental premise seems to be that during this pause, if it's an effective pause, relations between Iran and the rest of the world would change, so Iran would not be have an incentive to build that bomb. Is that fair to say? Is that what the is that a, an embedded assumption in this framework, Michael?
Tom, I think it's a hope. You're right. That's a crucial point here. Substantially, this deal is a 10-year deal. Some provisions last longer. It's important to note that there is no green light at the end of the 10-year, 15-year time frame where we say, okay, then you're free to build nuclear weapons.
But there are no more sanctions then, I mean, right? I mean, what's to stop them?
Well, Iran is a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, whose members have pledged not to pursue a bomb, and they have to have inspectors on their soil. So Iran would either have to do something covertly, which they could do now, or kick the international inspectors out of the country. But it's not the same as being under very punishing sanctions. But just, you know, briefly on that question of Netanyahu's response and our hope, I think there's an aspiration that Iran's behavior will moderate over time, and that when this deal is basically over, Iran will be a less threatening, dangerous country. The Israelis and the Saudis and others say, you're crazy. Iran is not going to change that fast. And Netanyahu's position is, don't put a time limit on it. Link it to Iran's behavior. When Iran stops threatening Israel, when Iran stops supporting Hezbollah, when Iran stops fomenting Shiite insurgency in Yemen and other places and supporting Bashar Assad, when Iran starts to behave itself in some, then it can have a normal nuclear program and join the community of nations, but not until then. And that's really going to be the crux of the coming debate.
And at the crux as well, President Obama looking for a different relationship with Iran. It seems you could hear that in some of his remarks in the Rose Garden, White House Rose Garden yesterday.
If Iran complies with its international obligations, then it can fully rejoin the community of nations, thereby fulfilling the extraordinary talent and aspirations of the Iranian people. That would be good for Iran, and it would be good for the world. Of course, this deal alone, even if fully implemented, will not end the deep divisions and mistrust between our two countries.
But that wasn't good enough for Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, among others, saying the framework deal reached with Iran worse than he expected.
The only acceptable deal would be Iran's nuclear disarmament. Even if Iran followed the terms of the deal, almost every term has a 10 to 15-year sunset.
Lisa Desjardins, how is this likely to be received in Washington? How's it been received so far?
Well, Tom, I think the only thing close to as difficult as working out a deal with Iran for the Obama administration will be convincing Congress that it should not take a vote on that potential deal. And I think while diplomats are working out the details and kind of the exact letter of this deal, that's going to give Congress a lot of time to speak out about this and consider how they weigh in, whether they weigh in. I can tell you right now, we're getting pushback from some very powerful Republicans already. Now, that pushback, I'll explain, but I should say it hasn't yet risen to the level of them saying they are demanding a vote on this or that they will block this per se. I think there's a lot of very tender consideration at this point. But I can tell you, we had House Foreign Affairs Chairman Ed Royce on our show yesterday, and he was very clear in his pushback that he felt for sure you cannot trust the Iranians. He also felt that the deal does not go far enough on another number of levels. And I know Michael will talk to a couple of those, but he thinks that this gives Iran basically too much power in its nuclear facilities, and he doesn't trust the inspections to actually go through. Now, so I think we're going to see in the next week when Congress returns — Congress is not in Washington today — when Congress returns, we're going to see this ramp up very quickly, and we'll have a sense of exactly how tough this is going to be for the president, perhaps as soon as Tuesday.
Jack, I want to come back and dig in on this with you, but first thought on this deal, Jack Beatty?
Well, we're going to have the first test of it on April 14th in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, when a vote will come up to essentially would force the White House to win congressional approval for a deal. That'll be an early test.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news and the Iran deal, framework deal in hand. Indiana, Arkansas, gay rights, religious rights, massacre in Kenya, 140-plus dead there, college students, terrible. California dealing with real, real dry issues, water problems. Lisa Desjardins joins us from PBS NewsHour, political editor there. Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, is with us from Washington. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. Jack, I want to back up to this deal just a little more here. What do you see in the Obama agenda that is being laid out for us, in all the effort that's been poured in here, in the performance of John Kerry, in the deal itself and its durability under the beating of debate it is certain to get in the coming weeks?
It is certain to get it. But, you know, I think Peter Baker in The Times today frames it nicely. For the president, this is a return to the original promise of his presidency and of his 2008 campaign. He was attacked for it during that campaign, for his statement that I will negotiate with our enemies, by other Democratic candidates, notably Hillary Clinton. He certainly was attacked for it by John McCain. And if John McCain had won that election, we wouldn't be here. If Mitt Romney had won the 2012 election, we wouldn't be here. This is the president's vision, to talk to our enemies, to try to work out some kind of deal. So I think he's touching the original promise. Now, whether that's going to help him with a vastly shrunken Democratic minority on the numbers on the Hill is another question. But you know, when you look at the rhetoric over the years that conservatives have raised against President's treaty making and negotiations and so on with our enemies, it's not a very one thing goes through it, and that is Neville Chamberlain. Tom Cotton has already likened the president to Neville Chamberlain. Well, so was Ronald Reagan by the National Review, likened to Neville Chamberlain for his intermediate missile agreement with Russia.
So Neville Chamberlain saying this as if you were getting weak-kneed before Hitler.
That's it. That's it. The opening to China by President Nixon, that was denounced again by the National Review and conservatives as treason, Neville Chamberlain, you know, appeasement, on and on and on. So this rhetoric, you know, there's a kind of stuck record there for conservatives, always saying that these deals leave the country weaker, even as the country has become, I think, stronger through them.
Lisa, what about the politics of this and how they're likely to play out? Are Republicans prepared to go to the mat on this? Can you get a sense of that yet? And what about the Israel question? When you have the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu putting out a statement yesterday saying that this framework would threaten the survival of Israel, historically, that might have been a deal killer, but now there are such kind of deep lines drawn here, certainly between Israel and the White House, maybe wider than that. How does all this play out?
You're right to bring up Israel because those two issues are completely intertwined in Republicans' minds right now, especially the minds of those like Tom Cotton, who are now out front saying, we think Iran is a greater threat than ISIS, than the Islamic State. We are more concerned about Iran in the long term than the Islamic State. And they're putting things in that framework. And for these Republicans, they see Iran as the greatest threat to global stabilization, the greatest threat, in a way, to the United States and especially to Israel. So there are certainly Republicans who are ready and who are now preparing to go to the mat and to block this with everything they have.
But on what criteria? I mean, you've got the White House going another direction, looking for a new relationship with Iran, suggesting that's where the American future lies. I mean, have Israeli and American interests parted ways here?
I think it comes down to something that Michael and Jack have both touched on, an issue of trust. These Republicans simply don't trust Iran on any deal. And as you heard in the great clip you played from Tom Cotton, they say the only thing we should accept is full-scale downsizing and complete erasing of the nuclear complex in Iran.
The Netanyahu demand.
That's right. Now, then there's others like President Obama who say that's never going to happen. That's completely unrealistic. So you have these Republicans who are taking taking a stance who's saying it is nothing or no deal, nothing or sanctions forever. And there's others in the Republican Party, some who are leaders in Congress, who do see the point that the United States must engage and must accept something else other than complete disestablishment of the Iranian nuclear complex. Now, that's the discussion that's happening within the Republican Party in Washington right now. But I do think even if all of the Republican leaders, Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, even if all of them were to get on board this deal, and I don't think they will, even if they were, we still have the issue of the United States Senate, where a single senator can block legislation if the Senate does move toward trying to approve a deal. Of course, then this gets into the mathematics of the U.S. Senate, which are special to our country and where you need 60 votes potentially to try and establish that the Senate has to ring in this deal. So there's a lot of complicated math here, but the point is the Senate, I think, is this the body to watch.
Let's go to our listeners. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air. What do you think?
Well, with all due respect to your guest, Tom, I think the Republican Party see their shadows as the greatest threat. Something is always the greatest threat, but I digress. Mm-hmm. I think this is a good deal. Two reasons why. One, internationally, this will hopefully blunt the arms war in the Middle East from Middle East countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and other countries trying to get nuclear weapons. Number two, domestically, I think more important, this has exposed the quote-unquote loyal opposition of the Republican Party from oppositions to standing in the way of everything to now just flat-out treason by spying on the country with Israel and writing a letter to the Ayatollah. I think this has exposed them. And if they insist on blowing up the talk by rushing legislation through, I think the president need to take the bully pulpit and just kindly remind the American public that the Israelis spied on us and passed on information to the Republicans. Just pound that, because I think that is the most disturbing bit of news that has come out of these meetings, that they took information from a foreign country that spied on us. And that's disturbing, guys. And I don't know how you all feel about that.
Carl, we've got it. And I appreciate your call. Michael Crowley, let me come to you on the regional arms race front. Does this framework, if it can be completed, if it can be all pinned down, does it look like it will, in fact, blunt or rein in the potential for a nuclear arms race in the Middle East? Or does it say to Saudi Arabia and others, you now have 10 or 15 years to get your own nuclear weaponry together?
Right, Tom. That's another one of the big questions here. And it's an important part of the president's sales pitch. So even as he continues to try to nail down the open questions and unsettled details of this deal. He is furiously selling it to Congress, to the American people, and to our allies in the region. And the Gulf state Arabs are a key constituency. The president has invited the Gulf Cooperation Council members, which is those Gulf Arabs that includes the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Kuwaitis. They're going to be coming and seeing him at Camp David. I believe it's later this month, where they're going to be talking about security assurances and their security relationship with the United States. That's going to be an incredibly important part of this sales job for the president, assuring the Sunni Arab nations that see Iran as a mortal threat, that America essentially has their back, is not abandoning them, is not entering into a new relationship with Iran that will supplant its strong security ties with the Saudis and the Emiratis and others. So that's an essential part of this. And the degree to which he succeeds will help to determine how much a country like Saudi Arabia and a couple others that have, you know, Egypt has made noises about this. Some Turkey has made some noises. The experts take some of this talk a little more seriously, a little less seriously than in some other places. Will help to determine that. But there have been very prominent Saudis who have said, not that if Iran gets a bomb, we're going to get a bomb. They have said if Iran gets a domestic enrichment capability, which this deal would allow, that would allow Iran to continue enriching uranium on its soil, well, we want what Iran is getting. And that would be the first step toward that kind of proliferation race that the U.S. wants to avoid. So again, these security assurances, these conversations with the Gulf Arabs that are beginning now are going to be critical to that.
One more call. We've got to move. Lots of news. Parisa in New Orleans. Parisa, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I have dual citizenship. Actually, I have triple. I'm French, Iranian, and American.
Okay.
So obviously, my view may be biased. But the point I'd like to make is that the sanctions are actually something a lot of people don't realize, is that the sanctions are, in a way, backfiring. Because since the sanctions have been established, the Iranians have found ways to trade with China and Russia using gold. So during this time, it has reinforced alternative economies, and China and Russia have been stockpiling gold and reinforcing alternative economies that actually threaten the U.S. dollar. So
look behind the scenes. You may see complicated reactions to sanctions. No question about that. At the same time, we could hear the excitement of Iranians who are happy to see those dropped. We know that there may be conservative resistance to this deal in Tehran as well as in Washington. It's going to be incredible to watch this play out. Parisa, I appreciate your call. We've got so much news to get to. We'll talk more about this, the whole deal and reaction to it, in this hour on Monday here at On Point. I want to turn, if we may, to the huge furor that erupted this week, end of last week, but surely blew up bigger this week, in Indiana, in Arkansas, over religious freedom restoration acts, so-called, and gay rights. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, here he is talking on Wednesday about trying to balance tradition and rights.
The bill itself does not pick winners and losers. It balances two competing constitutional obligations that our founding fathers gave to us. But the issue has become divisive because our nation remains split on how to balance the diversity of our culture with the traditions and firmly held religious convictions.
Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, who managed to thread the needle somehow, asking for some changes in the bill that was coming his way, avoiding some of the firestorm that Indiana surely did not avoid. Just people came down on them like a ton of bricks this week. They eventually got in there, brought some changes to the law, and wanted to be right out front saying, we love everybody. Here's Republican Indiana House Speaker Brian Bozma yesterday.
We value you, gay, straight, black, white, religious, non-religious. We value each and every Hoosier.
Well, that was the message at week's end, but that's not how it's being interpreted midweek. Lisa, you've been in Indiana. What has just happened?
I think what we're seeing is a real national moment on both of these issues that have been on a collision course for, let's face it, for years. And I think in Indiana, there's a fascinating dynamic where you have a state full of people who really don't need to be in the spotlight. When you talk to Indianans, they really would prefer to be out of the headlines nationally. They're a state that just kind of likes having their day-to-day lives and is proud of who they are. But they don't need to be like, I heard one person even said to me, Tom, we don't need to be like New York or California dominating the headlines. We're happy with who we are. We're uncomfortable with this kind of attention.
But conservatives threw in here big, Lisa. In Hoosiers and beyond, I mean, this was a big, deliberate drive to try and circumscribe gay rights. And this week, they're saying we've just taken a big setback.
Well, you mentioned the ton of bricks that fell on Arkansas's Governor Asa Hutchinson. Same ton of bricks on Mike Pence. And those bricks, they were owned by Walmart and by the NCAA. When businesses got involved, that is when this debate shifted. And I think the timing is really something to watch. It almost feels like an Aaron Sorkin episode. The fact that the Indiana law was signed within 2 weeks of the NCAA Final Four tournament coming to Indianapolis. The NCAA, which is headquartered in Indianapolis, I think that is what raised the pressure point to a national level when the NCAA said, we are not comfortable with this law. Then that just opened the floodgates. By the way, let's talk about these fixes here. Mm-hmm. There are two different versions. In Indiana, what they did is they passed a law that says that original law, the Religious Freedom Act, does not allow for discrimination against gays and lesbians and by sexual orientation or identity. But to be clear, the fix in Indiana doesn't itself eliminate discrimination. It only says that the previous law does not allow for discrimination. So that's something that gay rights groups and some businesses, including Angie's List, have said they think doesn't go far enough. They think discrimination is still legal in Indiana. It's just not codified in the way they thought it was by this original law. In Arkansas, they took a different path and instead passed a new law that basically parallels the federal Religious Freedom Act. So both states stepping down. And I think when you talk to religious conservatives, they're concerned that they see their world eroding. They think religious rights, especially those who are against gay marriage, they're worried that they're becoming more and more of a minority. And they do see this as a loss. Gay rights groups are not entirely satisfied with how this ended up. We should watch for potential protests still at the Final Four, but I think those protests will be small.
Brooke in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Brooke, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hey, Tom. I'm kind of a somewhat neutral party, despite the fact that that I am gay. And the reason why is because I currently, you know, you can walk into businesses and see a sign that says we reserve the right to refuse service, and you know, and you kind, I just kind of wonder how much this has been blown out of proportion simply because the word religion is in it. I'm somewhat neutral only because I do, you know, have many, many Christian friends and awesome people that I know, and none of them would ever refuse me service. And so I just wonder if this was kind of blown out of proportion because it's behind the veil of religion, and if it had nothing to do with religion, if it was just simply business owners having the right to serve who they want to serve and nothing more to it, and you didn't even throw in the gay, straight thing, would this even be an issue, or is this really just taken off because of that?
Jack Beatty, what about it? Religion here as pumping this up, or religion as a cover for a deliberate pushback on what we've seen as rapidly expanding gay rights, certainly around marriage?
Well, it certainly has been a cover, a sincere one. That is, you know, I've heard the Steve Inskeep did a remarkable interview with a Baptist minister in Indiana,
disciple of Christ, I think she
was. Yeah, okay. Who very clearly stated, I was for this law because I think people should have the right to discriminate on the basis of their religious faith against, say, the instant case of the florist having to provide flowers for a gay wedding. Shouldn't have to be forced to do that. I think that's the purpose of this law.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, 11 Atlanta teachers and administrators convicted of racketeering for changing student answers on standardized tests to improve test scores. They could face up to 20 years in prison. Here's Fulton Superior Judge Jerry Baxter.
I don't like to send anybody to jail. It's not one of the things I get a kick out of, but they have made their bed and they're going to have to lie in it.
Fierce sentencing still to come, but watch those numbers. A noose found hanging on the Duke University campus, the latest in a string of racially charged incidents on campuses around the country. Duke junior Jason Ross said something needs to change.
We are not afraid. We stand together.
Without dialogue and without having the knowledge, the ignorance that happens here on campus will prevail.
And Jon Stewart's successor at The Daily Show announced it's South African comic Trevor Noah. He took heat this week for jokes he had tweeted about Jews and fat women. Here he was with Jon Stewart on the show before the announcement.
You know what, Jon? Does America really need to be the best at everything? I mean, you already dominate the world in economics, military power, obesity.
We're looking at a week in the news, an Iran deal in hand, Indiana, Arkansas, gay rights, religious rights massacre in Kenya, California, very dry. Lisa Desjardins of PBS NewsHour is with us, Michael Crowley from Politico, and Jack Beattie. And Jack, I should just clarify, you were right. It was the Baptist preacher who talked to Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition who had that torn position but wanted traditional religious positions defended there. The Disciples of Christ preacher who opposed the RFRA, as they're calling it, in Indiana. I just want to be clear on that. Let me go to Dan in Providence, Rhode Island. Dan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I think the religious right is absolute, but what is not absolute is the privilege of owning a business. So if you want to practice your religion, you may do so, but when it starts violating the commerce and the ability to sell to everyone, not discriminating, your right says, I'm not going to have a business. So I think there's a commerce that supersedes, and that's a privilege, not guaranteed in the Constitution, unlike the religious freedom.
Inside the church or a place of worship, do as you will. But once you open a business, Lisa, you're in the realm of secular life and American rights.
Well, I suspect those businessmen would argue that business is a part of life like any other. But I think what the caller's getting to here is that this has really sparked a wide debate over American culture, which hits on our rights, our freedoms on both sides. I think initially we saw the first reaction to these RFRAs. We weren't able to get at that debate. It was sort of just a very strong reaction to something. Now what's nice is we are actually talking about when do religious beliefs trump potentially a form of discrimination or perceived discrimination by another group. I think that's what's really coming out of this at this point.
There's a move for non-discrimination protections on the basis of sexuality across the country. I mean, is that what lies behind this on the gay rights side, Lisa? A push to get more explicit written into law, you know, the same way we can't discriminate on race, make sexuality subject to the same kind of oversight.
There is no question about it. The gay rights movements have been pushing for that for years. Gay marriage has gotten all the headlines, but the truth is that gay activists for decades have been saying we can be discriminated against legally in the workplace in many states in this country. We can be fired because we're gay in many states in this country. That is something they've been working to overturn. And gay activists I talked to when I was in Indiana, both national and local, said they do think this is a turning point on those issues because you see now, as I said, Angie's List and other companies saying it doesn't go far enough to say we're not discriminating here. What you have to do is say we will not allow discrimination of folks for sexual identity or preference on any level, which is most states have not done that. And that's what gay rights groups are going to push for even harder now.
So this week, still well shy of that. Nevertheless, a big stand down in Indiana and Arkansas after a very pugnacious kind of performance just a week ago by Indiana Governor Mike Pence. Business came in on top of all the other uproar, and things changed. Kenya story, just sorrowful this week. 147, maybe more, killed when al-Shabaab fighters from neighboring Somalia took over a college dormitory in the town of Garissa, sort of a military garrison town, only about 100 miles from the Somali border. Kenyan troops have been involved in Somalia. Here was the Kenyan Interior Minister Joseph Ankasaris talking with reporters on Thursday after the brutal killings there of scores and scores of students. He said the death toll rose high before police and soldiers were able to secure the university and ultimately kill the terrorists.
This is a very sad day for Kenya. We, as I speak, it's unfortunate that the terrorists were able to kill young, good citizens very early in the morning before the operation started. And as I speak to you, it is sadly that we lost 147 lives.
Just horrific death toll there. Michael Crowley, echoes here of the shopping mall takeover and slaughter that we saw not so long ago in Kenya. What's going on?
Well, echoes indeed. It's the same group, which is Al-Shabaab, which is a Islamist radical organization that has kind of festered in the open wound of Somalia, and its status is essentially totally failed state now for the better part of, or essentially all of, the last 20 years. And so it has been crossing the border into Kenya, which is a much more, healthy, stable, and developed country. In fact, President Obama recently announced that he will be visiting Kenya, of course, the home of his father, this summer. So one imagines that the security will be tight for that visit, and security issues, cooperation with the Kenyan government, will be high on the agenda. One thing I would add here of interest to Americans is that there have been several Americans who have traveled to fight with the Shabaab in Somalia. There's a Somali immigrant community in Minneapolis, and this is a very big concern for U.S. officials who are worried about domestic radicalization, and they feel like there's a little bit of a linkage between that group and these immigrant communities in the U.S. So they watch this one with particular interest, even though Shabaab, relative to some of the other horrible groups that we've all been talking about, seem less determined to strike inside the United States. But they do have sympathizers within the U.S., and it's something that we're very concerned about.
A very carefully engineered attack that put the attackers in position to slaughter and hold Kenyan forces at bay. And a terrible, terrible death toll there. I want to bring it home for a minute to California. The snowpack there in the mountains that are so important to California's water supply, this year we're told at only 6% of their normal volume. California Governor Jerry Brown announcing mandatory statewide water restrictions. This was a press conference in the Sierra Nevada, an area that would typically, he said, have 5 feet of snow this time of year. He was standing on dry grass there. He said California needed an unprecedented water-saving measures, warned that life's going to change.
Now we are embarked upon an experiment that no one has ever tried, ever, in the history of mankind, and that is 38 million people with 32 million vehicles living at the level of comfort that we all strive to attain.
And many of them being reminded of how much desert there is there, how much California is vulnerable if we've got climate change or just a real big down dry cycle. Lance in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Lance, you're on the air.
Tom, thanks for taking my call. I went to college in California about 45 years ago and was amazed to see people using their garden hoses to wash leaves down their driveway into the sewage system. That is something that, if the governor didn't mention, needs to come to an end. And the golf courses out in the desert, they need to be replaced with something like AstroTurf. If I had the money, I'd invest in the company that makes the stuff, because that's what the golf courses are going to be. And on a comment on the last topic you were talking about the Indiana and Arkansas laws, I grew up in Indiana, and here in Cedar Rapids, I attend church with Liz and Trish Barnum, who were the two young women whose gay marriage case got to the Supreme Court. And I could comment on all three of these, but right now I just think that California really needs to get its act together and suck it up and find even small things, because small things add up into big things.
You attend church with them. Boy, that brings it right home. And memories of California water going right down the sewer system just to move leaves around. Now, first ever mandatory water restrictions will force cities and towns to reduce their water usage by 25% in the coming year. To your point on golf courses, Lance, it also orders golf courses to use less water, replacing 50 million square feet of golf lawn, I guess, with drought-tolerant landscaping, whatever that means. Of course, big caveat here, Lisa, it doesn't apply. This rationing will not apply to agriculture. Uses four times as much water as California's urban areas, the vast majority of the water in California.
That's right. 80% of the water in California is going to farming, and they are not affected by mandatory cutbacks under this. But there is a significant thing to watch here in that Governor Brown is announcing that those farms, for the first time, will have to tell the state exactly where they get their water from. How deep are they digging their wells? And that gets to really this kind of top-level problem for California, which is the groundwater table. They have problems with their reservoirs, but now that the groundwater is eroding from them, they really want to figure out who's digging the deepest wells and try to manage that. So there's a step in that direction, but you're right, farmers won't feel this directly. Who might feel it directly, maybe not this year or next, but soon, is the rest of America. You know, as I was driving over for this show, it's raining in Washington today. It's raining in a large part of the country, not in California. And so I think much of the country might say, California, this isn't going to affect us. But the truth is, especially in the agricultural front, this could very well affect food prices across the country.
Well, the percentage of broccoli and a whole lot of other vegetables that come out of California is incredibly high. Watch this space. A very important state, very important economy. And a very important kind of bellwether now of where we're headed with water supply, maybe climate. Niasha is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Niasha, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yes.
I love Trevor Noah, and I've been following his career from the very beginning.
This is the successor to Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, named this week. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I am excited as Zimbabwean. I feel that I should be as excited as possible, but I really worry about the kind of reception that he's going to get, especially as a foreigner who's going to be talking about American issues to an American audience. Now, granted, John Oliver has done it successfully, but this is an African man who's going to be critiquing American issues to an American audience. And I think that messes with a carefully selected narrative of America that we see abroad. So I just worry about the time it's going to take for the American audience to warm up to a foreigner who's going to be critiquing the country's narrative.
What do you mean that it messes with a carefully created narrative of America that you see abroad? I get that it's very interesting to put a South African in that chair interpreting so much American life, but what's your concern?
So in Africa, or actually outside the U.S., we see these narratives of America as this great nation that is successful, that is the savior to other countries in terms of social and political issues. But then you have someone who's going to be critiquing the social process, the political process, in a way that some Americans don't even do themselves. So it's almost as if he might be pulling the curtains back on some issues that are not openly talked about in American society. And I think there's a level of discomfort with that, which I don't know that people will be ready for.
I mean, that's very interesting. Jack, we may have seen that already just in these old tweets that got surfaced this week, and they were jokes about fat people, women in particular, and about Jews that were outside the norm of what is typical or accepted in this country. I mean, look, it's a few tweets and people said, don't make too much of it. But others said, wait a minute, what's going on? There could well be a kind of cultural clash, enlightenment, how others look at things, Jack, but something different here.
Yes, and it may well be that the heightened, the sort of charged response to that is an intimation of exactly what our caller was saying, that there's a great sensitivity, or maybe a too great sensitivity to a, quote, foreigner talking about our ways. On the other hand, the whole sort of geist of The Daily Show is to really look at things fundamentally, and the kind of upend settled convictions, even liberal convictions, of more and more, it seems to me. And what could be more welcome there than someone who's from outside the country and who can really look at us as we seem to people abroad and bring that kind of perspective, which of course can be an inherently comic perspective, since it's always about the gap between our profession and our our practice.
Comic or inherently challenging. Lisa, just for a minute, Democratic Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey. Now, looking at these federal corruption charges over his relationship with a rich, what is it, doctor in Florida.
That's right. You could say eye doctor, right?
Eye doctor, okay. He says, look, this is just friendship. The charges say, no, this is corruption. How about it, Lisa?
The Justice Department could have gone for lesser charges here, and they didn't. They went for bribery. That's something that we haven't seen since the Abscam scandal, and it's a very serious charges. We're talking about $1 million in gifts. And what's astounded me reading through the indictment, $750,000 in campaign donations in just 2012 from this man to
wow.
Menendez and his causes. Yes. And what they're saying here is, as a result, Menendez got these gifts and this money, and that he helped his patron, as the Justice Department accuses him of being, with things, everything from helping bring his girlfriends in the country, that he reached out to the State Department to get visas for several women, and that he also tried to help notably with a potentially a Medicare overbilling case that was working its way and was going to be a big issue for this man, and that they're saying Menendez interceded on his behalf. So very serious allegations. Menendez says, hey, we were just friends. Yeah, it's normal.
Friends
it's
in
going
high
to be
places.
It's going to be a tough case, yes.
Michael Crowley, just 10 seconds, but Tikrit is taken. Does that mean, hey, here we go, ISIS is going to be tossed out of Iraq?
There's still a lot to do, but it's really crucial to break ISIS's momentum and show that they're not inevitable, that they can be stopped. So it's really good news.
But what a picture here. American air power supporting Iran-backed militia on the ground, and then the Iraqi army put out front for the photo op on the way into Tikrit. This story is not over. Michael Crowley, it's always great to have you. Senior foreign affairs correspondent with Politico. Thank you so much for being with us today, Michael.
Always love doing it, Tom. Thank you.
Lisa Desjardins, political editor for PBS NewsHour. Thank you for your insights today, Lisa.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Jack Meaty, thank you to you in so many ways. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.